Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck. I appreciate all of you joining me on this wrapping up, I guess, the first full week of trading in 2021. And boy, oh boy, it was a wild week to start this year. If this week is any indication of what's going to happen for the rest of this year, it seems like 2021 might be even more historic than 2020. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it gives me a lot to talk about this week and throughout the year. I'm kicking off this weekend show with a good friend of the show, Mike Larson. He writes the Safe Money Report. Now, Mike, let's talk about the broad market environment now that we have the results from the runoff election. And we can say that there actually was a blue wave in that U.S. election. What does that mean for markets now?
Sure. Thanks again for having me on, especially here at the start of the new year. It really is amazing when you look at what 2020 included, and everybody kind of was looking forward to turning the page and starting 2021 with a clean slate. Obviously, on the political front, that's not what we got at all. I mean, we've had this crazy activity in D.C., the storming of the U.S. Capitol and so on. Clearly, from a historical and sort of political and constitutional perspective, it's shocking. It's amazing to see, and it really makes these next couple of weeks interesting to see in terms of whether, you know, Trump gets impeached, whether there's even time to do it, whether his cabinet gets together and tries to just replace him according to the Constitution, Amendment 25. There's all kinds of crazy things going on that just makes you think, geez, I hope 2021 is not a sequel or just a continuation of what we had last year in terms of turmoil. But from a market perspective, if you look at just the economics of it, the market pretty much sailed right through what was going on and has been strong right out of the gate here in the start of the year. And I think that really does come down to what you mentioned, the blue wave scenario. For a number of weeks, it's been sort of looking to me like we would be entering this year and see a year with a money flood environment. Basically, the Fed continuing to pump money into the economy and the market, regardless of what happens really with inflation and economic growth. On top of that, additional huge amounts of stimulus from the Biden administration and Congress, especially if the Democrats were able to get that effective majority with the tie in the Senate and then the vice president being the tiebreaker, which is in fact what happened. That's going to turn that extra fiscal stimulus dial up all the way to 10. You look at that scenario where you have a monetary authority that's just going to be printing and buying bonds like mad and keeping rates pegged to zero for ages. And you layer on top of that this enormous amount of fiscal stimulus, everything from aid to states, $2,000 stimulus checks, tax cuts for some, some individuals and all these other incentives for things like clean energy and infrastructure spending and on and on and on. Again, it's ocean of money that's going to be flooding out of Washington towards Wall Street and the economy. And naturally, investors are looking at that and saying, you know, who cares about the longer term implications for debts and deficits? This is a party time now. So that's why you're seeing markets strong out of the gate. And indeed, it's really not just stocks. I mean, if you look at the performance in the back half of 2020, when you can kind of see the scenario coming, it wasn't just U.S. stocks. It was global stocks. It was gold. It was silver. It was mining shares. It was Bitcoin and other cryptos. I mean, really, the commodities across the board, very strong performance, indicative of a market that knows an enormous amount of money is coming its way from D.C. and from other foreign capitals.
So when it comes to policies that Biden might put in, but that Biden even campaigned on, what do you think are the ones that we will see first? What do you see is most likely to come out of the gate? Because you're right. Look, there's a party in the markets and it's all about making money now, not making money a year down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at what Chuck Schumer, the incoming Senate Majority Leader, has just said, that the first, and this confirms what the Biden administration officials have said, it's that they want to top people off with $2,000 checks. I mean, we've had 600 already. They're going to, they want to get another 1,400 thrown on top of the pile very soon. So I think that's the first priority. I think next you're going to see, you know, the things that Republicans were standing in the way of before, such as aid to state and local governments. That's probably going to be next. I think infrastructure and clean energy, especially, they want to satisfy the environmentalists, and that's a big platform there. So, you know, it's no surprise that right out of the gate, you saw ETFs and stocks that, you know, that are involved in solar and wind and everything like that soaring 7, 8, 9, 10% in a day. You know, so that kind of stuff. I think those are the top priorities that you're going to see. And later on, it's going to be broader tax and spend policies. It's going to be other things like, you know, incentivizing research and development and trying to bring manufacturing back onshore and taxing foreign, foreign-owned or foreign-earned profits and corporations, on the other hand, and taxing the wealthy, the people at the high end of the income spectrum, to pay for at least a portion, but clearly not anywhere near all of that. So again, it's a complete, you know, shift in priorities from what we had under a Trump administration. And with it, you know, with the ability to have both houses of Congress for at least the first 2 years, you know, Biden's going to have that backing to basically push a lot of this stuff through. And, you know, normally you would have a Federal Reserve that would kind of counterbalance that a little bit. But this isn't normal. This is a Fed that is convinced that, you know, if you look at what they're saying, there's a few Fed people have come out in the last few days and said, you know, we might need to taper by the end of 2021, or we might, you know, eventually look at winding this thing down. But come on. I mean, we look back at what happened coming out of the last recession under the Obama years and the Bernanke Fed, what happened, right? The economy and the stock market and everything bottomed in the first quarter of 2009. The Fed, you know, despite some talk that, oh, they might, you know, taper it, or, you know, they might get out of this QE business, they ultimately launched three rounds of QE, not just the round that was launched in the midst of the crisis. Then Bernanke didn't even start insinuating or hinting that he might raise rates until May of 2013. That caused a taper tantrum where stocks tanked and bond yields surged, which made the Fed chicken out on QE tapering all the way to December 2013. They did it over a long span of time. It took forever to wind that down. Then they didn't start raising interest rates until December 2015, which was, you know, 7, 8 years after they cut them to zero. So, you know, and that was in a scenario where the economy was in better shape ostensibly than it was in the midst of the COVID crisis. And that was in a time when you would at least expect, you know, because of the cycle before that, the Fed would do what normally happens in economic improvements. They take back the punch bowl. You know, there's no evidence whatsoever this Powell Fed has any inclination to take away the punch bowl, or, you know, when push comes to shove, if the markets even get into a little mini tantrum, I mean, forget, you know, a 3-year-old screaming, we're talking about like a little kid who has to burp and pat on the back. If the markets even do something like that, then they're going to backtrack faster than you can imagine. And it's going to be, again, it's going to be, in my opinion, a much longer stretch of pedal to the metal on QE. Rates pegged to the floor, regardless of what inflation and unemployment and growth are doing. And that just means that you're going to, again, you have a situation where the money flood is not going away now. It's only going to get bigger. And down the road, you know, it's likely that none of this stimulus is going to be withdrawn early or in advance of when it probably should. If anything, it'll happen far too late after the markets have really gone overboard.
Okay, so you are not buying into any of the recent comments from the Fed president, Hawker or Bostic, that we could be tapering by the end of next year. Hey, fair enough. And you know what? You're not alone in saying that these guys are not going to be able to follow through with that. But what about what the bond market is telling us? Because we do have, especially the long end, yields are rising. It was just this week, too, that the 10-year popped over 1%. And as we're recording, it continues to hold over that level. Do you see the Fed doing anything when it comes to yield curve control? Anything else like that?
Sure. Think of what you just said. The 10-year yield has popped over 1%.
Oh, I know. I agree. The bond market's broken.
100%. We're certainly in an environment where the idea of a bunch of fiscal stimulus and, you know, the economy getting better coming out of the worst of the COVID crisis, especially as the vaccine rollout continues, that's going to lead to higher interest rates in the short, to some degree, even intermediate term. But I think we're going to be talking about baby steps here in the bond market, not leaps and bounds. I mean, you have to remember just the way bond market math works and amortizing works. The greater amount of debt that you're trying to amortize against any given interest rate, the smaller the increase in the interest rate that you need to see before that basically breaks you. If you owe $100 and your interest rate goes up from, you know, 1% to 2%, who cares, right? You barely notice the pain in your monthly budget. if you have $100 billion and the interest rate goes from 1% to 2%, I mean, the amount that that means you're paying extra if you have a variable rate is astronomical. So because we have piled so much debt at the corporate level, at the government level, at every level on this economy, it would take a much lower level of interest rates before the whole house of cards comes crashing down, whatever metaphor you want to use. So given that that's the case, in my opinion, we're never going to see double-digit 10-year yields like we had, you know, back in the early 80s for many years. We might not even see 2% interest rates or 2.5% 10-year yield for quite some time. Because, again, when you've layered all that debt on top of an economy, much smaller increases in interest rates break things. So it's why for 30 years now, every single peak in the interest rate cycle, Fed hikes and so on, has ended at a lower and lower level of interest rates. Look at Japan. They've been pegged at or below or near zero for, what, 30, 35 years now? So, again, you know, that's kind of what we have to keep in the back of our mind. So, sure, rates could go up. They are going up. Do I think we're going to see some catastrophic increase in interest rates? No, I don't, because the fallout would be enormous.
That is fair. But now what about on the flip side when we talk about inflation, balancing out inflation break-evens? Those are also rising. The 10-year inflation break-even is at levels we haven't seen since mid-2018. Let's start with inflation and the potential that that carries this year in terms of, I don't know, throwing the Fed off course, doing anything, actually.
You know, I think that the Fed has already said, if you go back to their own, you know, statements, they've said they want inflation above their old 2% target for a period of time to balance out the period of time during which inflation was below 2%. So again, is the Fed going to react to, you know, the sort of inflation rate at 2%, 2.25%, 2.5%, even 3%? No, they're going to say that's a good thing. They say, well, it's been 1.5 or 1 for so long. We want it to, you know, average 2.5 or 3 to get back to this average 2 level. So, you know, it's a new regime in sort of Fed policy. It's a new way of thinking. Unless the bond market absolutely forces the Fed's hand, which, again, is going to be very hard in terms of its impact on – it'll be a self-destructive move, right? If interest rates start soaring, again, given the debt-laden economy and given sort of the valuations built into the stock market that are all dependent on, you know, low rates forever, it's going to take a much smaller amount of interest rate increase to break things, for things to get ugly. So that's why I think that, you know, again, the level to which interest rates can rise is a lot lower than it was in the past. And again, why the Fed's going to do all it can to avoid that outcome.
Yep. Hey, fair enough. The Fed is in there. The Fed has told everyone that they're going to be in there, even if they haven't done it in some of their statements. But either way, everyone knows that the Fed has their back when it comes to the bond market. Can I also get your comments on this U.S. dollar? It continues to break down. Well, it's close to breaking down. There are a lot of arguments, whether it has already broken down, whether it is breaking down. Where do you stand on the dollar action?
Sure. I mean, if you look at something like the DXY, the dollar index, it is, you know, it's broken some technical levels of support. It hasn't completely fallen out of bed. It's been more of a steady decline. But, you know, that in an environment where we're in the sort of print, borrow, and spend forever environment, where we're in one where asset reflation isn't just a side effect, it's a goal of policymakers. And when you layer in, again, sort of this deterioration that we're going to see in the U.S. balance sheet as a result of the enormous amount of borrowing and spending that's going to go on, you know, I tend to, I'm not a huge dollar bear, but I do tend to think it's going to continue to sink here. And as if you're a U.S.-based investor, that's all the more reason to be looking at things like gold, silver, mining shares, and even some high-yielding foreign stocks or ETFs. So I think given that scenario, what would spike the dollar? It would have to be some kind of panic, you know, fleeing back into dollar assets, which of course is going to be accompanied by, you know, other ugly things like a collapsing stock market. And, you know, I don't really think that's the likeliest scenario. I think the slow bleed scenario that we've seen in the dollar is likely what we're going to continue to see, you know, for the foreseeable future. So again, from a policy and an economic standpoint, I think the move we've seen so far in DXY is right. And I don't really see any reason for it to change anytime soon.
Yeah, fair enough. And it's very easy to tell on the chart, too, that any sort of bounce is getting sold into. So yeah, that tells you a lot about the dollar. Let's wrap it up with a comment on commodities then, because you have mentioned a wide range of commodities, everything from precious metals to base metals to clean energy type of commodities. Which ones do you see outperforming? Because some are going to do better than others. Do you have insights on that?
Sure. You know, earlier I have been a little skeptical of base versus precious metals. I prefer precious to base. You kind of were trying to steer me in the base direction, and you were right. So congratulations on that one. I think that clearly, if you look at what's going on with things like copper and so on, it's a response to the stimulus. It's a response to the economy coming back from the worst of the COVID dark days back in the spring of 2020. And I think that, you know, again, if you believe, you know, I'm certainly warming to that. And I'm certain, especially for something like silver, which has a little bit of both the precious exposure and the economic exposure. I think that looks really solid to me. So I think that in this sort of asset reflationary environment, but one that's not going to be shut down quickly by rising interest rates, in my opinion, especially policy directly controlled rates, there's a lot of potential there. So I think, you know, and especially, again, especially after the blue wave results in the election, that's going to be a lot of concrete money coming into the economy and in the real economy, not just the asset market. So I think you throw that all together and that those kinds of trades you're seeing, the rebound in oil, for example, all of that stuff is probably going to be with us for a while. So I don't think you fade that move.
So I guess in summary, it's sounding like 2021 is the year to be invested. Make sure you are invested, obviously be diversified. But if you're sitting in cash, just like in 2020, that would be a losing trade.
Yeah, I think the one last thing I'd put in here is that you've got to be very careful about when bullish market behavior turns into euphoria. And, you know, there are some worrisome signs on that regard. If you look at this avalanche of money losing IPO direct that Wall Street's dumping on the market and all these SPACs, these special purpose acquisition companies, where they don't even have a business, they just go out and raise billions of dollars because of whoever the guy is sitting behind the desk. And they say maybe someday we'll actually buy a business that someday actually delivers profits. You know, that kind of stuff, you're seeing a lot of that really junky issuance. You're seeing junk bond yields at all-time lows. I mean, there are some things that again, you want to keep in the back of your mind and just say, hey, is this still bullish or are we in the euphoria stage? And if we're in the, you know, if we make that transition, you know, that's when you got to start unloading and selling into as opposed to continuing to buy things and lever up on. So, you know, those are the things I'd keep in the back of my mind. But all in all, for now and probably for a while, this money flood environment is going to be with us. And leaning against that is probably not the best thing to do.
All right, Mike, great chatting with you, buddy. Thanks for kicking off the New Year's show. I guess last weekend was also the New Year's show, but now we actually have market moves to talk about for 2021. And boy, oh boy, again, it's been a wild week. If anybody wants to follow Mike, I recommend following Mike on Twitter, @RealMikeLarson. He's posting all day, every day with a lot of valuable insights. So I'm a follower and it really helps you stay on top of everything that's going on. Mike, again, great chatting with you. Have a great rest of your weekend, buddy.
Thank you. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.